Rachel Carson's seminal work, Silent Spring, arrived at a time in our collective history when technological advancement, increasing human population, and pollution, often largely unregulated, began to have highly visual local and global impacts. In an era of increasing insertion of the visual medium of television into our common culture. The book itself was highly referenced with the scientific literature, yet written in a style that was accessible to the public. In that era, the era of better living through chemistry, society was experiencing a rapid influx of new products into the marketplace that resulted from the boom of technological advances in the industrial runout of World War II. New drugs, new agricultural chemicals that were accelerating a green revolution, and new materials, such as advanced plastics, all fueled the vision of President John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. The vision for social change helped focus the internal challenges of our society, challenges that included civil rights, environmental justice, a lack of governmental and marketplace transparency, and an environment that was becoming increasingly polluted. In the U.S. and across the globe, many waterways were visually contaminated, trash was accumulating on roadways, and the urban smog that burned your eyes was so dense that obscured building tops were a common sight in many major cities. In the rush to develop and deploy these new technologies, in the absence of precaution and knowledge of their potential for negative as well as positive impacts, it soon became clear there may be a darker side to many of the products and processes, and that in some cases, the risks of a new technology may outweigh the benefits of that innovation. The multidimensional social, economic, and environmental analysis that Carson undertook was new for its time, and it spoke to a greater concern that humanity has the technology, but perhaps not the wisdom, to control the natural world. A scientist herself, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring called for caution, especially precaution, with technology, not abandonment. Her ability to give voice to nature changed our perception of the natural world, and in doing so, she changed the world.
DDT. It was cheap, effective, and we loved it.
The real threat to the survival of man is biological, in the shape of hordes of insects.
But one woman challenged the way we looked at chemicals and nature, giving us a new vision of the future. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, tonight on The American Experience. Major funding for this series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the financial support of viewers like you.
Corporate funding for The American Experience is provided by Aetna for more than 135 years, a part of The American Experience.
Good evening and welcome to The American Experience. I'm David McCullough. It's happened many times. A book, a single book, has changed American life, changed our history. The book itself became an event in the American experience. There was Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, the little woman who started the Civil War, as Lincoln said. In 1906, a book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair awakened the country to the horrors of the Chicago stockyard. And in less than 6 months, Congress passed the first pure food law. Closer to our own time came Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed, with its shattering indictment of American automobiles. Tonight's story is about one of the most important of all such books, this one, Silent Spring, and its brave, unlikely author, Rachel Carson. It was not Rachel Carson who discovered the deadly impact of pesticides on the natural world, nor was she the first to write about it. But when she did, it was both as a scientist and as a writer of exceptional power. She began her landmark work in the 1950s, when for a woman to speak with any authority in science was extremely rare. And remember, too, she was on her own, with no university or institutional backing. Yet no universities or institutions, no politicians, not television or the newspapers, sounded the alarm as she did. Rachel Carson changed our lives, changed how we think about the world and our place in it. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring.
Pesticides had become a way of life in post-war America, and by 1955, the country was being treated with more than 600 million pounds a year. But in 1962, the chemical industry, the government, and agribusiness were accused of poisoning the environment in a book called Silent Spring, written by Rachel Carson.
Can anyone believe it is possible to lay down such a barrage of poisons on the surface of the earth without making it unfit for all life? They should not be called insecticides, but biocides.
Rachel Carson painted a nightmare vision of the future. Silent Spring polarized the nation, and the ensuing controversy changed the course of history.
A great book has a flow to it, and it changes people's minds, it changes their outlook, and it has a long reach. Rachel Carson's Silent Spring is still affecting our thinking and our policy making today. The essence of Rachel's message was that we had to come to terms with nature and work with it and not against it. In a complex modern society, of course, that was a very radical concept, but in the sense of a change in our thought, I think she was revolutionary.
Silent Spring was a terrifying exposé, and its crusading author was quickly swept into the public eye.
The reporter continued, "No one in either county farm office who was talked to today had read the book, but all disapproved of it heartily."
Rachel Carson was no stranger to fame. In 1951, her book, The Sea Around Us, had won universal respect. It made the New York Times bestseller list for 86 straight weeks, a new record. "Once or twice in a generation," wrote one reviewer, "does the world get a physical scientist with literary genius. Miss Carson has written a classic." All of her writing grew from a fascination with the natural world that she first found as a child in western Pennsylvania. Rachel was introduced to nature by her mother. It was a world with which she made an immediate and lifelong bond. She had always wanted to be a writer, and by the age of 10, she was already making her own books.
The Little Brown House. Once upon a time, two little wrens were hunting a little house to set up housekeeping. All at once, they saw a dear little brown house.
Everything about the miracle of nature was her religion. She had a lot of unhappiness in her life, but I think that her love of nature kept her sane and sweet.
She believed in herself as much as she believed in nature.
I am an idealist. I may never come to a full realization of my dreams, but a man's reach must exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?
In the 1920s, women were not encouraged to be scientists, but at Pennsylvania College for Women, Carson decided to be a biologist. It was an unconventional choice, but she was determined. She earned a master's degree in zoology at Johns Hopkins. In the early 30s, she taught college biology and spent one summer researching marine biology at Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It seemed for a while that she had found her life's work in pure science, but it was not to be.
Her family had been in very reduced circumstances for years. They had quite a struggle to put her through college, even. At that point, the family was her mother, her father, her sister Marion, who'd been divorced, and Marion's two little girls. And in rather short order, within a year, her father and her sister died. So there was Rachel and her mother and the two little girls, which is why Rachel didn't go on to get a doctorate, I'm sure. She had to support the family.
It was 1936, the middle of the Depression, and Carson needed a steady job. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was hiring biologists, and she went to work for them at a salary of $2,000 a year.
Rachel was one of the first two women ever hired at a professional level in the service. When I first met Rachel, she was assistant editor for the service. We all brought our lunch and would eat it in the office, and we also made tea illegally in the closet in the afternoon. There was a very strange for a government building, people laughing hilariously. There was a lot of laughter in that office.
Bob Hines, a colleague and illustrator, remembers going on collecting trips with Rachel Carson.
From the tide pools in Maine, where the water is pretty cold, she would pull these specimens out and put them in a bucket, and we'd take them back to the cottage that she had rented, and I'd draw them, and then when I finished, she'd put them back in the bucket. Then we took them back and released them in the same spot from which we had taken them. And it didn't matter whether it was morning, noon, night, or midnight. We had to go back and drop them back in their own little homes, and that was a good idea.
She moved up in the Fish and Wildlife Service as a science writer and researcher. In 1941, she wrote her first book, Under the Sea Wind. Those who read it recognized a great talent and a powerful new voice for conservation. Carson expressed her beliefs when she became editor-in-chief of all Fish and Wildlife Service publications after World War II.
The preservation of wildlife and wildlife habitat means also the preservation of the basic resources of the earth, which men as well as animals must have in order to live.
In 1951, the sea around us gave readers a fresh and compelling understanding of the natural world and their place within it. In spite of her fame as an author, the public knew very little about her.
They did not put her picture on the jacket of The Sea Around Us, and people would meet her and their faces would fall. Rachel was a rather small, delicate, pretty lady, and they said, "You're not at all the way I imagined you." I did a painting, actually, of Rachel as her readers imagined her, this great Juno-esque figure out in by the sea on a cliff in a storm clutching an octopus.
People often seem surprised that a woman should have written a book about the sea. This is especially true, I find, of men. Then, even if they accept my sex, some people are further surprised to find that I am not an oversized Amazon-type woman. I can offer no excuse for not being what people expect.
She was a feminist before her time. I think she had had to fight against the bureaucracy when she was in the Fish and Wildlife Service. She had worked with men a lot, and she got along well with them, but she really fought for anything that she believed in, and she didn't let anyone push her around. She had enemies because she didn't compromise very easily. She spoke her mind and was rather blunt at times.
After Carson's third book about the sea, one of the nieces she had raised died, leaving a four-year-old orphan son. At the age of 48, Rachel adopted the boy, Roger Christie.
I never forgot that I had another mother who was a real mother, but, you know, Rachel was my mother too, after my mother died. We would spend a lot of time on the beach, obviously. She would find something interesting and call me over and, here, look at this. And she was a great one for getting down and peering under the rocks. And she was very concerned about keeping alive a sense of wonder in children. It was more imparting a philosophy, you know, a way of looking at things.
The success of The Sea Around Us had given Rachel Carson enough financial security to quit her job. She built one house in Maine and another one in suburban Maryland, where she settled in with her mother and young Roger. Carson's life was comfortable, but her thinking was radical for the time. In The Sea Around Us, she railed against what she saw as the heedless arrogance of man.
He has subdued and plundered the continents. In the artificial world of his cities and towns, he often forgets the true nature of his planet, in which the existence of the race of men has occupied a mere moment of time.
Her concern was not shared by many. One biologist remembers the direction that most of the country was taking.
Remember that we had been benefiting from about 50 years of gung-ho technological development. Right after World War II, for example, especially, we went into a binge in developing new technologies.
One of these was chemicals. It had spawned a giant industrial complex, and it gave us a bewildering variety of plastics, drugs, lubricants, fertilizers, and among the most important of all, pesticides. Poisonous chemicals that kill pests, such as blights and parasites or insects, that destroy crops and carry disease. The most famous pesticide at the time was DDT. It had saved millions of lives in World War II by preventing the spread of disease. It was cheap, effective, and apparently safe.
It was a military secret during the war. It was smuggled in from Switzerland. It had been sitting there for 50, 100 years, but nobody had ever tried it on insects. And they found that it was a very potent chemical for killing certain insects. I'm told that World War II was the first war in which more people were killed by enemy action than by diseases.
A terrible disease in warfare is typhus fever. And it has been said to have ended most wars because in the final stages of the war, troops developed typhus fever from body lice. But in World War II, DDT spraying killed the lice and typhus fever was stopped.
The United States faced a different kind of plague, insects that annually ravaged its farms. Following the war, DDT and other pesticides were put to civilian use on a massive scale. They worked wonders and production exploded. Synthetic pesticides were like miracle drugs, or so almost everyone thought. But a storm was brewing.
In the world at large, this was the only country that began to say, hey, wait a minute, there might be something here that isn't quite as advertised. Some people were actually worried about it, and the Fish and Wildlife Service was one. And the center of activity at that time, in terms of the research being done, was Patuxent National Refuge in Maryland.
At Patuxent, near Carson's home, Her colleagues had been investigating the impact of pesticides. As early as 1945, she had tried to get the Reader's Digest interested in an article about these tests.
Practically at my back door here in Maryland, an experiment of more than ordinary interest is going on. The experiments show what other effects DDT may have if applied to wide areas, whether it may upset the whole delicate balance of nature if unwisely used.
The magazine turned her down, but over the years, evidence was mounting that some pesticides were deadly to wildlife.
We found that some strange things were happening. For example, people came in to us in the late 50s and said, you know, there aren't many eagles left around here, and they're not reproducing. And other people came in and said, well, it's the same thing with the falcons.
The chemists and the agriculturists knew that DDT killed insects. They didn't know why. They didn't ask why. It was enough that it killed insects. It seemed to be enough for them. They should have been more curious, but they were not. They were practical people, and they went to work.
From 1945 to 1955, annual pesticide use on farms went from 125 million pounds to over 600 million. Soon, government agencies began treating even the suburbs with DDT.
People thought it was a good thing because they got action in solving a problem as they conceived it. They were, for example, complaining about mosquitoes. And if the spray truck came down the street, they were told to just stay indoors for a few minutes and everything would be all right. So you had the government endorsing a product and you had the chemical industry pushing it very aggressively.
There was a development program going on within the corporate system saying, well, a little bit is good, but a lot more is much better, isn't it?
Public health departments staged demonstrations to convince the public of DDT's effectiveness and safety. Enthusiasm for the chemical knew no bounds, and few were questioning the wisdom of such use. Public places and private backyards were being treated whether people liked it or not. In 1957, planes sprayed a Massachusetts bird sanctuary owned by Olga Huckins, a friend of Carson's. In fury and desperation, Huckins told her what had happened. The birds showed all the symptoms typical of DDT poisoning. Huckins knew that the planes would be back in spite of her protests. She asked Carson for help. Carson later remembered how the thought of a spring silent of birdsong had moved her to action.
It was your personal letter to me that started it all. In it, you told what had happened and begged me to find someone in Washington who could help. It was in the course of finding that someone that I realized I must write the book.
The ornithologist Robert Cushman Murphy of the American Museum of Natural History sued the USDA to prevent the use of DDT in controlling the gypsy moth on Long Island. He lost his case on technicalities, but obviously, there was a lot of concern before Rachel Carson came along.
Carson studied the trial records and found that they were full of chilling evidence of the dangers of pesticides. She wrote her literary agent of the first inklings of a powerful idea.
Having finally struck pay dirt, I feel I should do an article. I'm sending along a somewhat haphazard memorandum, which does incorporate a few of the horrifying facts about what is happening through the mass application of insecticides.
She tried to get articles and things like the Reader's Digest or other leading magazines. Nobody would touch it. In the first place, they had advertisers to worry about, I suppose, and it was a disagreeable, controversial subject, and
Carson's dire warning was that by poisoning nature, people were ultimately poisoning each other and subverting what she considered a fundamental right to a healthy environment.
If the Bill of Rights contains no guarantee that a citizen shall be secure against lethal poisons distributed either by private individuals or by public officials, it is surely only because our forefathers could conceive of no such problem.
Pesticide certainly wasn't an obvious subject for a successful book. On the other hand, Rachel was dealing with a subject that we all felt was important.
Paul Brooks, editor-in-chief at Houghton Mifflin, had been in on the project from the beginning.
Now, I don't claim that we knew this book was going to have the impact it did, but it was obviously something in the tradition of Houghton Mifflin publishing by an author whom we had liked and who had published successfully and whom we had encouraged to do a book on this subject. So there was no doubt on anybody's mind about our taking it on.
The whole thing is so explosive and the pressure on the other side so powerful and so enormous that I feel it far wiser to keep my...
Carson would be attacking a powerful, well-organized industry. Her case would have to be airtight. Persuaded by the evidence that she had uncovered, she set out on a crusade. Late in 1958, she wrote to Paul Brooks.
Broad conceptions will reveal the futility and the basic wrongness of the present chemical program even better than ranting against it, though I shall rant a little too.
She had to absorb an overwhelming amount of data. She was working alone and desperately needed help. She wrote to Brooks with good news about a new assistant.
I was extremely lucky to stumble upon a secretary who has an incredibly right background. If I had set out to make someone up, I could hardly have done better.
When I met her, she told me she was Rachel Carson. And I was so stunned because there she was, you know, the author of The Sea Around Us. So she told me that she had a contract and was supposed to have the manuscript in by the 1st of January, and she wasn't anywhere near ready. She felt very bogged down by these masses of materials and trying to keep track of them. And
many people in universities or government agencies or even industry who were on her side were very helpful, but they had to do it extremely carefully. This man later said he thought the most useful thing he'd done in his whole career was slip stuff to Rachel Carson when she was writing the book.
Carson was outraged to discover within the government a pervasive attitude of secretiveness and denial. One field worker wrote, "The USDA representatives have consistently downgraded the biologists' findings on damage to fish and wildlife. They have refused to give me information, saying no significant wildlife damage occurs." John George found the Department of Agriculture reluctant to publish methods of safe pesticide disposal.
Well, the administrators didn't want to bring out any information along these lines because it might leave the impression that pesticides were dangerous if you've got to be careful at how you got rid of them.
I was up against industry and agricultural experiment station personnel who insisted that the way they used these chemicals, they did no harm, and that the people who insisted otherwise were either misled or were being paranoid.
Some people she quoted in the book lost their jobs very quickly. You didn't speak up against the establishment on this, even for such innocent things as saying, no, we do better with Dutch elm disease if we don't spray the trees, to clean them up. That man lost his job.
The book was beginning to take shape, and Carson wrote to Paul Brooks.
All the pieces of an extremely complex jigsaw puzzle are at last falling into place. It is now possible to build up a really damning case.
Carson attacked what she saw as a heavy-handed, public-be-damned attitude behind certain government programs.
There was a mindset against insects. They really focused on the bad ones without realizing, I expect, ecologically, the vast majority of control of insects is by other insects. And you see, the moment you step in and play God with a chemical, you can get into some real problems. You just can't eradicate an insect with a chemical. I think you've got to be a little more imaginative than that.
They sprayed truck gardens and dairy farms, fish ponds and salt marshes, showering insecticide over children at play. A quarter horse drank from a trough in a field which the planes had sprayed. 10 hours later, it was dead.
See, all the big programs prior to that were largely federal lands. This was a big federal program that began to treat private lands, including farmlands. And all of a sudden, the milk was contaminated and the farmers couldn't sell their milk. And people were worried about their wildlife. It just led to a clamor.
Carson attacked the government for exaggerating the threat of insects like the fire ant.
During most of the 40-odd years since its arrival in the United States, the fire ant seems to have attracted little attention. With the development of chemicals of broad lethal powers, there came a sudden change in the official attitude toward the fire ant.
Human beings have lived with and have battled insects for many centuries. Now the war is between man and the imported fire ant.
Fire ant mounds could interfere with farm machinery, but the insect itself was only a nuisance. The government, however, insisted it was a serious menace in need of eradication.
This was a favorite word, eradication. And Congress bought this, you know, because, boy, if you eradicate it, then you'd never have to worry about it again.
Dieldrin was one of the most effective pesticides, but it was 40 times more toxic than DDT. Even so, millions of pounds of Dieldrin were spread in the Deep South by the Department of Agriculture.
Urgent protests were made. The protests were ignored. 1 million acres were treated the first year. The Agriculture Department brushed away all evidence of damage as exaggerated and misleading.
I'm out in the field in Georgia with a control entomologist, and Dieldrin was 3 inches thick on this meadow. Horses, cattle, sheep, mules, roosters, cats, dogs, everything had died in that particular area. And this person is saying, no effect.
Who has the right to decide that the supreme value is a world without insects, even though it be a sterile world, ungraced by the curving wing of a bird in flight? The decision is that of the authoritarian, temporarily entrusted with power.
She used to write a lot at night. She'd write till 2 or 3 o'clock, then sleep late in the morning. And she'd ask me to type it for her. And then she would start cutting and patching and adding to it and taking out. We worked hand in glove together. Whatever had to be done, she did or I did. And here I was getting a preview of a great book that was evolving sort of from the depths of creation.
Carson was appalled by how easy it was to get deadly chemicals. One colleague's experience with the pesticide TEP is recalled by John George.
TEP is really the refined essence of the German nerve gases. It's a very powerful compound. This was a 4-ounce bottle of 40% TEP that he had purchased in Washington, D.C. on a grocery store shelf. Now, this stuff is so potent that if that bottle had dropped, broken, and it had splashed on the leg of whoever dropped it, he'd be dead. There wouldn't be any doubt about it. Just dermal toxicity would have killed him. Today, we use some of the refined essence of those compounds in agriculture. But any farmer that uses these is trained today, and he goes out looking like he's going to go to the moon. You know, he's protected. But the average housewife or a gardener may not have all these protections.
Some 7 million pounds of parathion are now applied to fields and orchards of the United States. The amount used on California farms alone could, according to one medical authority, provide a lethal dose for 5 to 10 times the whole world's population.
It was 1960. Carson had been working without let up on the book for 2 years, and it had grown from 6 chapters to 17.
Writing really came pretty hard to Rachel. She often said it was a lonely business. When she'd gotten into a subject, and finally she felt that the subject was taking it over from her herself, then she knew that she was getting somewhere.
For the first time in the history of the world, every human being is now subjected to contact with dangerous chemicals from the moment of conception until death. The control of nature is a phrase conceived in arrogance, born of the Neanderthal age of philosophy, when it was supposed that nature exists for the convenience of man. It is our misfortune that so primitive a science has armed itself with the most modern weapons, and that in turning them against the insects, it has also turned them against the earth.
In the 5 years I was intimately a part of her life, I don't think she ever went to a concert or a movie, partly because of her health.
I knew her for 19 years, I think, and almost every year she had some illness that disrupted her work.
By March of 1960, a first draft of the book was finished, but she had developed an ulcer and a series of other ailments. A visit to her doctor brought chilling news. She wrote her close friend, Marjorie Spock.
There were two tumors in the left breast. One was benign, the other suspicious enough to require a radical mastectomy. I'm giving details to special friends like you. Somehow I have no wish to read of my ailments in literary gossip columns. Too much comfort to the chemical companies.
She was unbelievably brave. I just still marvel that she got that book written, because some new complication would come up. It seemed almost every week she'd have a new problem with iritis in her eyes or rheumatism. She was in pain, I think, all the time, and I used to drive her to the hospital twice a week for radiation treatments, which were very hard on her, and she lost a lot of hair and had to get a wig. It was terrible to go through it with her.
I was as ill as I've ever been in my life. I had to be taken to the hospital to complete the second course of radiation for the tumor. I have been having cortisone injections for the arthritis.
She thought that this was pretty overwhelming, and am I going to manage to do it? And so there were days when she actually couldn't write at all. But she had that determination.
The only good thing in all this is that the long time away from close contact with the book may have given me a broader perspective. Now I'm trying to find ways to write it all more simply.
One colleague wrote to her, "You are rendering a tremendous public service, yet I warn you that you are going to be subjected to ridicule and condemnation. Facts will not stand in the way of some confirmed pest control workers."
I guess all that sustains me is a serene inner conviction that when the book is done, it is going to be built on an unshakable foundation.
I think she loved every word she wrote. You know, it's like somebody with a glorious voice and an opera singer. She enjoys that voice and is glad that God blessed her with it. And I think that's the way Rachel felt about writing.
The New Yorker magazine was going to print excerpts in the spring of 1962. The book would appear in the fall. When the magazine's editor told her he had read the final manuscript at one sitting, unable to put it down, Carson wrote to her friend, Dorothy Freeman.
I knew from his reaction that my message would get across. I played the Beethoven violin concerto, and suddenly the tension of 4 years was broken, and I let the tears come. The thoughts of all the birds and other creatures and all the loveliness that is in nature came to me with such a surge of deep happiness that now I had done what I could. Now it had its own life.
human being on Earth who doesn't have some element of this notion of beauty in an environment. What she was doing was adding a dimension to a technical argument. She introduced something which one as a scientist presumably not supposed to do, and that is to recognize the emotionality in people.
The New Yorker articles aroused both fear and anger. It was clear Rachel Carson had called into question the integrity of the entire pesticide industry. Velsicol, one of the largest chemical companies, claimed Carson had lied about two of its products.
The Velsicol company tried to stop Potenefrin from printing Silent Spring with this blast trying to prove it was inaccurate and that anyone who was opposed to pesticides was a tool of the communist menace.
This letter from Velsicol was obviously a threat to stop publication if we went ahead with it. They had also made a similar threat to the New Yorker on the basis of the three sections that the New Yorker had already published. And we and the New Yorker both told them that the facts had been checked and that we were going to go ahead.
Secretary Udall of Interior at the time, he was impressed by it. And I got the pleasant message from the secretary, would I document every statement that she had made? And of course, I could have done that, but I was able to wiggle out of it by saying, Mr. Secretary, she's going to publish a book and everything will be documented in the book.
There were people, scientists in my department, concerned about DDT and pesticides, but I can assure you, when I became Secretary of Interior, their voices were in the background and they didn't have the attention of policymakers.
But the subject of pesticide overuse came up at an August news conference held by President Kennedy.
Have you considered asking the Department of Agriculture or the Public Health Service to take a closer look at this?
Yes, I know that they already are. I think particularly, of course, since Ms. Carson's book, but they are examining the matter.
The New Yorker excerpts had primed the public. When the book was published on September 14th, the Consumer Union had already ordered 60,000 copies. Within 2 weeks, it was a bestseller.
I remember a conversation with President Kennedy where he brought the subject up, and he had a very quick mind. But getting it into the consciousness of the president, getting action in the White House, was very important. I had the good sense to take the advice of my people and champion Rachel from the beginning, because we saw that that was our mission and that she was in effect giving us a new charge. But the chemical people, the chemical industry, the agribusiness people, they began speaking up, and you had in effect a pitched battle.
Any possible angle was going to be used to discredit her. She was a hysterical woman. She was a bird lover or something.
They tried to clobber her, beat her down with the weight of their opinions, and some of them were distinguished men.
It was attacked by the American Medical Association. It was attacked by Monsanto, who said, in effect, that we were turning the world over to the insects. But the lowest of all was when she talked about the effect of all this on future generations. And this person came out and said, well, she's a spinster, isn't she? What she know about future generations?
The chemical companies were really searching for some way to bring her down by proving that she was hysterical and didn't know what she was talking about. She wasn't a trained chemist.
Their trade association had signed $250,000 just to fight this one book. The result of this was that there was infinitely more publicity than Houghton Mifflin could ever have afforded in their advertising. We had never had anything remotely like this kind of attack, and it backfired very much to our advantage.
Some of the harshest attacks on Carson came from industry scientists such as Dr. Robert White Stevens of American Cyanamid.
The major claims in Miss Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, are gross distortions of the actual facts, completely unsupported by scientific experimental evidence and general practical experience in the field. The real threat, then, to the survival of man is not chemical, but biological, in the shape of hordes of insects that can denude our forests, sweep over our croplands.
He was a very eloquent person, a great speaker, and he did most of the talking, I did most of the writing, I guess.
Now, although there are a number of scientific errors, misquotations, and obvious misinterpretations in her book, it must be admitted that much of her material is, in part at least, scientifically accurate. The area of disagreement between Miss Carson and students of applied agricultural chemistry, however, will lie in her clearly misplaced emphasis.
When she turned to Silent Spring, she became very vindictive and very inaccurate and very selective in what she presented. And it was that I took issue with. One of the bad things about the book was it made people terrified of pesticide residues in foods. And that stays with us to this day, even though the residues are not even present. There is a great value to bringing in the public into these debates, but the public have to be supplied with authentic information. And we felt that Silent Spring had not done that.
This is the kind of tug of war that we are exposed to in the beginning of a public controversy. And nobody knows the real answer. Everybody stakes out a claim, and we argue it the best we can.
As far as Rachel was concerned, I don't think there was another side of the story. I think she was, so convinced that we were destroying the earth with the careless use of pesticides that there was no room for doubt.
Sales soared. The book went into second and third printings. It was a Book of the Month Club selection. Before the end of the year, Robert White Stevens had given 28 speeches, and pesticide bills were introduced in 40 state legislatures.
I was probably 11 when Silent Spring was actually published, so things were very black and white to me. Rachel was the good guy, and anybody that was attacking her was were the black hats. We collected all the cartoons, the editorial cartoons and that sort of thing. And there was a whole lot of commotion. The CBS people came and did an interview at our house in Maryland.
Carson was weak from continuous radiation therapy. She made few public appearances, but agreed to be in a CBS report about the controversy. The program's producer was Jay McMullen.
About 2 weeks before the broadcast, the network came out with its publicity about what was the broadcast all about and who was going to be on it and all of that. Two very interesting things happened. We got more than 1,000 letters, which was an astonishing amount of mail. Never had that much mail before a broadcast went on the air. First of all, they're all mimeographed. They all said the same thing. In essence, be fair about this issue. I thought they were from the chemical industry, but I could be dead wrong about that. Now, the second thing that happened was that the two major sponsors of the program pulled out. They said the program was not the kind of showplace they wanted for their product. I imagine that most of the public, and certainly most of the our audience for The Silent Spring of Rachel Carson, had never seen or heard Rachel Carson speak before.
We've heard the benefits of pesticides. We have heard a great deal about their safety, but very little about the hazards, very little about the failures, the inefficiencies. And yet the public was being asked to accept these chemicals, was being asked to acquiesce in their use, and did not have the whole picture. So I set about to remedy the balance there.
Dr. Robert White Stevens was eloquent all the way through. He was never at a loss for words. He wasn't embarrassed for his industry.
The crux, the fulcrum over which the argument chiefly rests is that Ms. Carson maintains that the balance of nature is a major force in the survival of man, whereas the modern chemist, the modern biologist, the modern scientist believes that man is steadily controlling nature.
Now, to these people, apparently the balance of nature was something that was repealed as soon as man came on the scene. Well, you might just as well assume that you could repeal the law of gravity. The balance of nature is built of a series of interrelationships between living things and between living things and their environment.
The day following the broadcast, Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut announced that the Senate would hold hearings on pesticide use.
If it weren't for Rachel Carson, I never would have had these hearings. I was not aware of the extent and the importance of the problem she raised. It became important that this was an area the government had a responsibility of determining what to do about it, because no one else was going to do it.
Carson knew that the only way to bring about lasting change was to encourage government to take a leadership role.
First, I hope this committee will give serious consideration to a much neglected problem, that of the right of the citizen to be secure in his own home against the intrusion of poisons applied by other persons. I speak not as a lawyer, but as a biologist and as a human being. But I strongly feel that this is or should be one of the basic human rights.
I've always known philosophically that one who believes is a majority, because most people don't believe in anything. And here was a person that really believed and was right. See, what people don't understand is that Rachel Carson wasn't for the complete outlawing of pesticides or chemicals to help agriculture. Her point of view was that it was over abused, that it wasn't used properly, it wasn't under control.
During these hearings, the President's Science Advisory Committee released its report. It vindicated Carson's warning and ended with this conclusion: until the publication of Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, people were generally unaware of the toxicity of pesticides. But Silent Spring transcended the pesticide issue and forced people to think about the environment in a new way.
The thing that was predominant and up front when I became Secretary of Interior was the emergence of the atomic age, of the atom changing our lives, of the conquest of nature, of technology as being the great thing that was going to change the world and change our lives. And the natural world was pushed into the background. I think Rachel Carson brought it out of the dark corner and put it up front and challenged all of us to say, well, can you really ignore nature? If you think of her as a revolutionary, it's rather startling. But in the sense of a change in our thought, I think she was revolutionary.
She had drawn disparate pieces of evidence into a cohesive whole and had made a powerful case for the interconnectedness of all life. She had given dramatic meaning to an unfamiliar word, ecology. She was showered with critical acclaim. She was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Letters, one of only four women in a membership of 50. Silent Spring was translated into 22 languages. In the summer of 1963, Carson went to Maine, where she could be near the sea and her closest friends, Stan and Dorothy Freeman.
The Freemans were jovial people anyway, I think that's when Rachel came alive, when she was with the Freemans and up there in Maine. Rachel told Dorothy that she knew it was her last summer, and she knew that she would never see monarch butterflies again because they always migrate in the fall. And she said, I won't be here to see them in the spring when they come back. And she wrote a beautiful letter to Dorothy.
This is a postscript to our morning at New Agen. Most of all, I shall remember the monarchs, that unhurried drift of one small winged form after another, each drawn by some invisible force. Did they return? We thought not. When any living thing has come to the end of its cycle, we accept that end as natural. For the monarch, that cycle is measured in a known span of months. For ourselves, the measure is something else, the span of which we cannot know. When that intangible cycle has run its course, it is a natural and not unhappy thing that a life comes to its end.
Rachel Carson died 2 years after Silent Spring was published. She never thought that one book could make a difference, but within a decade, sweeping environmental laws were enacted. She has been called the fountainhead of the modern environmental movement. As one writer observed, a few thousand words from Rachel Carson and the world took a new direction.